one of the beauty of ADCs is actually that they're not, they're an innovation in science, but from a treating perspective, from a treating oncologist, they're not that big of a leap. If you work with antibodies and you work with chemotherapy, you pretty much know what to do with that.
Hello and welcome. My name is Charles Spence, host of A Dose of Reality, where we discuss some of the hardest parts about clinical leadership and how to build a meaningful career. Join me as I interview leaders, share career insights, and help you on your journey to becoming a global clinical leader. In this episode, I speak with Ilaria Conti. She has been working with ADCs for the past 3 years, first with AstraZeneca, and now is the VP of Early Clinical Development over at ADC Therapeutic. She moved from Italy to the US in 2001 and worked at the Dana-Farber Institute, Harvard. She then moved into the industry, working global positions at Lilly and then into executive roles over at Merck and then AstraZeneca. Now, what I love about Ilaria is her passion, her positive energy. She's clearly someone that lives and breathes clinical research, which is very clear from her message at the end of the podcast. So part one, you're going to learn a bit more about Ilaria, why she got into this world. Part two, we discuss the ADC market. Part three, we explore Europe versus US and the benefits of having an international career. Enjoy. Hi, Ilaria. How are you?
Hi, Charles. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very, very well. We were just having a wee little chat before this, and this is our first video call, so it's actually fantastic to see you in the virtual flesh, even though just as that sentence left my mouth, I can see how weird that sounds. So do all this again, maybe. How are you getting on anyway? It's sunny here in Berlin.
Well, it's sunny here in Boston, but it's chilly today. So yesterday we had a gloomy day of rain, so I'll take the sun and the cold. It's all right.
Amazing. Good. Spring is slowly coming. Lots to talk about. I've always enjoyed your energy, and you tick a few boxes for me and for what a lot of people are interested in. And that is European companies going into the US, or candidates as well. A lot of them look at the US, and also the kind of hot interest in ADCs. So I'm keen to get into some insights from yourself. But before doing that, I want to learn a little bit more about you, who I'm speaking with. And I like to sometimes go all the way back into how you first got into medicine. So how did you get into medicine? What was your childhood like? give me the story.
Well, I have no teary story about my childhood. I had a very happy childhood. I was an only child. I grew up in Tuscany, which is, you know, a nice place to grow up in. And I didn't think about going into medicine until pretty much halfway through high school. In Italy, you pick your final, you know, profession and decision for university right in high school. There's no college. At my time, there was no college. In the meantime, so halfway through high school, I had to decide what I want to go into. And I happened to read a book of this famous Nobel Prize laureate, Italian woman, Rita Levi-Montalcini. She was one of the first first Italian woman to win a Nobel Prize. And she won her Nobel Prize for her research in neurology. In particular, she discovered the nerve growth factor. But her life was amazing. And the fact that she had all that passion, all that drive to research, it really made me think. I mean, I want to do this. I want to study this. How do I get there? And the quickest and easiest way to do it seemed to, you know, become a doctor. Also, I had in my family, I had a couple of, you know, great examples of medical people, my uncle, amazing doctors, very humane people. I mean, models to look up to. So it was a very easy decision. My mother was totally against it. She came from a family where doctors were, you know, always out and working the craziest hours. So she didn't want that for me, but I ignored it, as every teenager should do. And I just signed up. I took my test. I got into the med school and I never regretted it. I really loved it. So that's how I got into medicine.
Amazing. You often hear people say, you know, what's been a transformative book? Do you, it seems like you really credit a lot to that book. Do you think you still would have naturally found your way into medicine without reading that book?
Yes, I probably would, because the science has always interested me. I'm curious by nature, even too much according to my family. But curiosity, I think, is the driving force of, you know, science. And maybe I would have explored medicine anyway, but that really gave me this eye-opening experience. Okay, this is what I can do. Because one thinks of medicine, of being a doctor and curing patients, which is great, is amazing, is rewarding. But there are a lot of other things that doctors can do, and sometimes they're not exposed to it. Now a bit more, but, you know, 30 years ago, it wasn't that immediate, especially for women, that, you know, you could pursue a career that is demanding, but still be happy and realize life and have a fulfilling life and so on. So I think that mostly pointed me toward the research, you know, direction. I probably would have ended into medicine.
Yeah, amazing. So you went into medicine, you graduated from medicine, and then you made your way over to the US. So this was as a postdoc. This was part of your clinical research when you went to Harvard. Yeah.
Yep.
Just talk me a little bit about that. We were kind of touching on this before the call, how this shaped your decision into the industry. But yeah, talk to me about your first years in the US and how it shaped you.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, I credit my mentor at the time at Harvard for the rest of my career and my passion for research. So I graduated, I got my specialty degree also. And when I enrolled in my PhD program, there was this opportunity of doing my research in a lab at Harvard. I connected with this professor whose research I really enjoyed. And we connected, you know, I got accepted into his lab to do my postdoc. And my experience was, you know, how can I say this? It's a shock in a way, but a positive shock. So the academic system in the US can be very competitive, but it can also be extremely rewarding. If you want to learn, you have the best people around you. On my floor next door to our lab, we had somebody that eventually got the Nobel Prize in medicine 4 years ago. You could go around and talk to people that were the expert, the gurus in their field. Everybody, in my experience, everybody had been extremely eager to teach, to help. My lab co-workers were international. I met people from all over the world. I still retain friendships with, you know, some of these people, and you know, we're very close. So it was an experience in many ways. And the research was, of course, top-notch. You had the best facilities, the best access to everything, information, money, because that's important too, right? When you do research, funding is great. Greatly important. So for me, I learned a lot. And then I decided, because that was my initial purpose, go learn, bring, you know, enrich my skill set with something I can bring back to my home country and, you know, help my academic institution there to grow as well. And that's what I did, or at least I tried to do. So I went back and, you know, at the time, I don't know if things have changed massively now, but going back from Harvard is difficult because you are at the top of your game there in terms of research, what you can do. So everything, at least in Italy at the time, was a little, you know, it could be a little bit of a disappointment, if you will, going back. But I went and I was very motivated, but the academic institutions at the time weren't that open to people that weren't willing to wait and wait and wait in line and not necessarily get their position based on merit, but more on seniority. I've never been very patient, to be very honest. That's one of my biggest defects, patience. But I felt like you know, yeah, you have to stay in line. You've been out, you got your postdoc, you were at Harvard, that was great, you've learned a lot. You can bring it to us, but you've just had to, you know, simmer here for quite a while before you get your position in your lab. And I didn't feel it was right. I didn't feel it was for me. So I said to myself, what is another opportunity? Where is another place that I can get to do research and impact really people's lives on a large scale? And to be very honest, pharma came to mind almost immediately because I knew people that worked in pharma and had fantastic experiences. Now, pharma doesn't, we have a bad reputation, and I understand that we have a bad reputation. But I can assure you that, you know, pharma, for us researchers and physicians, is a great place to impact people's lives because the amount of influence that you can exert by working and developing drugs that can save people's lives or cure disease or prolong lives is impressive. As a doctor, you do a lot for your patients, for your individual patient, and you take satisfaction by curing one or treating one or making a patient's life better. As a pharma clinical developer, you can actually do this on a scale of potentially millions. And it's incredible, the amount of reward and satisfaction that you get. So my choice was quite straightforward. And again, I've never looked back. I'm very happy.
Amazing. And I would agree with you. The people outside of pharma, there's a real negative image. And I was guilty of it. I don't know if you've ever seen the film, The Constant Gardener.
Yes, I have.
Yeah, and that just and there, of course there are bad players. It's a multi-billion slash trillion dollar industry. Of course there's going to be people, you know, your Martin Shkreli's of the world. I'm going to make it, the problem with it. And going back to what is it? Elizabeth Holmes at the blood company. I think it's Theranos. It's when you manipulate data, you're not just making money like let's say your tech companies are or your banking companies, you're really affecting people's lives. But actually you realize that is not even 0.1% of the people in the industry. And then when you do speak to, you know, people such as yourself, you realize actually people do genuinely really care and you make a huge impact into the lives of many people. Talking about impact, then let's segue into a big area that everyone's talking about and something that you've been involved in for the last few years, and that is ADCs. Why is it? It's been around for a long time, Ilari. Why is everyone talking about it now?
They've been around for a long time. It's true, but as everything. You know, ADCs are something I like to say that get better over time, like wine. Technologies, the improvement in technology has really affected the ADC development. And what some of the, you know, they're complex to make. And I'm not going to go into the details of it. First of all, because I'm a doctor, I'm not, you know, an ADC builder. But there are a lot of moving parts. Literally, there are a lot of moving parts to ADC. So there is this antibody. The antibody has to recognize a target and the target has to be engaged. And then attached to the antibody, there has to be a payload that has to be effective, but not too toxic and has to fit right in the molecule. So it's a very complicated things to put together. Technologies that have enabled this coupling, this linking, the streamlining of this process have impacted the ADC world a lot because that was part of the difficulties of why these drugs that have been around for a long time haven't been always super successful because they had some pieces that, you know, would come apart. Now we are, I would say, at the forefront of the research, and I can say that a lot of the companies that do this now do really well. I am a bit biased because I work for a company that does this, and this is our thing, and they really do it well. I think the fact that we can build them much better helped a lot. Then a lot of other things happen. Immunotherapy happened. And why is immunotherapy important for ADC? One could argue, right? It's actually something that could get in the way, and actually not. because the immunotherapy, in a way, paved the way to a lot more opportunities for a combination of agents that are very specifically targeting tumors. It kind of, for the first time, really proved that you can build something that goes pretty much where you want it, and it doesn't really affect everything around it. And that conceptually paved the way, but also practically, because immunotherapies are super effective drugs that some, in many cases, require the support of something else, like the traditional cytotoxic or other immunotherapy. And ADCs are specifically designed for that, because ADCs can provide a great companion to any immunotherapy, because they both go specifically on the tumor, they exert their effect in a limited area, and they can work together, you know, very, very, very well. Of course, there are ADCs that don't need immunotherapies and immunotherapies that don't need ADCs. But unfortunately, not all cancers are created equal. My mentor at the Dana-Farber used to say, we're never going to cure cancer. We're going to cure some cancers, and we're going to make the life of a lot of patients with cancer, you know, happy and long. Think our objective should be transform cancer into, I don't know, hypertension, diabetes. People live with it, people die with it, but people don't die of it in many cases because there are treatments. So there are drugs like ADCs that can be given for a prolonged period of time that can, they have minimal, well, they're designed to minimize side effects. And there has been a great interest lately because of great successes also that have happened in the industry with some specific drugs. And I can think the drugs that are used to treat some forms of breast cancers. I mean, ADCs are now transforming lives of patients with breast cancer. And I think that's amazing because women with breast cancer now live tens of years. They don't live 3-4 years. They have very long life expectancy. So for us women, and we know that unfortunately, 1 in 8 women in the Western world will be diagnosed with breast cancer at some time in their life. Hopefully their diagnosis will be early. Hopefully all women will do their screening. They have access to their mammogram and screenings. But even for those that are not that lucky to be diagnosed early, there's still a lot of, and ADCs are a big part of that. So lots of developments, lots of new technologies, lots of precision medicine that goes into that. And also another piece, besides the technology that is improved to build the ADC, is also the ability now to identify a lot of what we call targets for these ADCs, these molecules that are expressed almost exclusively on cancers, and that can help us direct the treatment on the cancer cells rather than on the normal tissue. Because, you know, as we all know, the problem with treatments for cancer, any other disease actually, is that you try to target one disease, but sometimes your medicine affects other organs, other areas of the body, and that's where the problems come. So ADCs are designed to minimize that, and the ability, again, technology developments to identify specific targets to actually aim at that are only on tumors has improved the value of ADCs tremendously. And that's what also happening. So I think it's a, you know, juncture of a few things.
And what are some of the common pitfalls? Let's say I'm a medical oncologist. I've worked with small molecules. Maybe I've even worked in immunotherapy, but I've never done ADCs. Mm-hmm. Is the entry here pretty easy? It's straightforward, or are there actually subtle mistakes, subtle pitfalls that only people such as yourself, Ilaria, realize now working in it?
Well, it depends what angle you're coming from. From a treating physician perspective, if you're familiar with that monoclonal antibodies and you're familiar with small molecules, venturing in the space of treating patients with ADCs is not that big of a leap. Okay. It's not from chemotherapy to immunotherapy. It's not, and especially if you also have experience with chemotherapy. It's not a big problem. From a drug developer perspective, there are unique things that could, they are very specific to ADCs, but that comes from a fact that an ADC is a combination between an antibody and a payload. Payloads are, as of today, mostly chemotherapy based. So you combine the effectiveness of the chemotherapy and the precision of an antibody, but you have to be careful because you also combine the potential side effect of an antibody that are mostly immune mediated and potential side effects of a chemotherapy that are cell toxic. So you can have toxicities that are off target, not necessarily in the tumor. However precise your design can be, there's always a minimum amount of off-target effect because sometimes these antibodies, these payloads get separated from the antibodies and they kind of, you know, venture around the body and they can engage other cells. But I think that, again, as I said, as a drug developer, if you have developed monoclonal antibodies, it does really help. Because you know a lot of what could happen from an antibody perspective. Remember, as of today, the common consensus is that the main toxicities that derive from antibody drug conjugates are driven by the payload. So any oncologist in the world would be familiar with the common toxicities of chemotherapy because if you are more than 40 and you are in oncology, you have used chemotherapy in your life.
Sure.
So you are familiar with that. So it's a bit of, you have to set your mindset, okay, I'm using two things together here. I'm using an antibody, I'm using chemotherapy, and I have to think of what can happen to my patients, whether it's in a clinical study or on my chair, you know, in my oncology ward when I give them this drug. But I would say that one of the beauty of ADCs is actually that they're an innovation in science, but from a treating perspective, from a treating oncologist, they're not that big of a leap. If you work with antibodies and you work with chemotherapy, you pretty much know what to do with that. So that's also the beauty of
them. Yeah, that's good to know. So then from the scientific perspective, if someone's holistic, they'll have a good feeling of this. Then let's go on the business side. This technology has been around for a wee while, but we've mentioned there's been some technology steps which have allowed ADCs to also progress. Before this interview, I was speaking to someone in the radiotherapy space, and the challenges there have been being able to get enough of that radioisotope, which is in their case, you know, the toxic payload delivery, and then also being able to have strong enough supply chains. And so how these companies are targeting it, some of the companies are doing the exact same thing, which, you know, AAA Novartis has produced, but they're just targeting one other, perhaps another business area. Perhaps their supply chain is better. Perhaps their procurement of the, you know, isotopes, lutetium, whatever, is better. So what are the components in ADCs? You've got the payload, the modality, the supply chain. What are historically some of the challenges from a business perspective, and what has improved and what is still improving, which therefore allows the technology to get better? That was a very long question, so I hope you got that.
I can walk through it in a very simplified way, and please, the purists that are going to listen to this, don't hate me. I'm trying to make it simple enough for me to understand. The main components of an ADC are three: the antibody, the payload, and the linker. So antibodies are antibodies. They're not extremely difficult to make, but they're lengthy. So it takes time, it takes money, and it takes a big facility to make antibodies. There are no small molecules. They need to be made in reactors. It's a long process. So that you have to have the ability to make the antibody as a technology and to make them quickly and to make them. Then you have your payload. And payload, as I said, are chemotherapy-based. There are immunotherapy, immunomodulators-based. And to go back to what you were saying, there are also efforts in the field to link radionuclides to antibodies. So that's another layer of complication. I don't want to go in there because these are radioimmunoconjugates, so I'm talking different things. So the payloads per se are based on chemotherapy, but they're not the raw chemotherapy. You don't take, I don't know, docetaxel and stick it onto an antibody. You have to modify it. You have to make it able to stay on a molecule. And what makes the antibody and the payload? So the payload has to be modified, and you have to have the technology for that. But that's not the hardest part. What really is key to the success of an ADC is the linker. The linker is this little thing that keeps the antibody and the payload together, but not only keeps them together, it allows for the payload to be released at the right time in the right place. So you don't want these two to be always together because you're never going to get the effect of your payload. But you don't want the payload to, as soon as it's injected in the body, to go everywhere by itself because it's going to be toxic. Remember, this is, in many cases, chemotherapy. So the linker is the key point. And a lot of efforts and a lot of time is spent to design and manufacture linkers that are optimal. They stay, they keep the two parts together, they're cleaved, they're cut at the right time, in the right place. This, I think, is more complicated. It what makes the ADC complicated, building this three-pronged structure. So the manufacturing piece has three components rather than one or two, and that's how things can become really lengthy also. They're long to make, to be very honest. They're not easy, but they're long. They can be, you know, some parts can be easy, but they're long. So the manufacturing, the supply chain, all can get into the critical path of a clinical study, for example, when you decide to make a big investment in, okay, we're seeing some signals, early signals of activity in phase one. Now we have to ramp up production to expand, right? To go into your larger studies, going to your phase twos, phase threes. That is where the long time and the big money needs to come in. And for some companies becomes, you know, a critical point. Because you have to have the infrastructure, you have to have the science, you have to have the money.
So that makes sense. Okay. So ADC Therapeutics, company you're at now, what are they targeting? How are they trying to improve this problem, so to speak?
Well, I think so. As I told you in our prior conversations, you know, over the phone before this, I think this company is really unique. For me, as we said many times, was a logical step because I was into ADCs and I was looking to, you know, make my way into biotech. This is the perfect company that only does this. We are specialized in ADCs. We are actually a company that's really unique because we have capabilities that go from research and development. Like, you know, we make our own ADCs, we have a validated technology, we have platforms, we have multiple warheads, we have different targets that we're going after. We can do our own clinical development, and we even have a commercial side of the business. So I think for a company that has around 300 employees, we are pretty much a one-stop shop for a lot of what happens with ADCs. So of course, you know, we're small, so we have we work with third-party organizations, both from a development, a research perspective and from a clinical development perspective. But the science is all in-house, which is, I think, amazing. And we are now going off. We have a solid platform that is already part of it. It's on the market already. We have an approved drug. And we also have part of this platform in the clinic in solid tumors and hematology. But we also have novel platforms. When I say platform, I mean an array of different antibodies that target different targets with payloads that are different. So we have the ability of incorporating multiple payloads on new targeting antibodies. So I think we are, in this respect, we're really a very, you know, self-sufficient, if you will, company for that. We're going after, so one of the things that this company is doing, and I have to say, I mean, it's unique in that way because it's small and efficient, but this is the new frontier for ADCs, is trying to really expand the area of ADC beyond hematology, beyond the usual suspects in solid tumors, because as I said, cancer, ovarian cancer, these have consolidated valid ADCs, now even gastric cancers. But we're really trying to target hematological malignancies and solid tumors, rare cancers that are really in need of treatment. There is an unmet need. There is huge for some of the tumors that we are actually targeting, and we are rolling our clinical studies. So I think one of the other great things about this company is that we really are trying to pursue cancers that are with at the highest unmet need. And this is what, as a medic, as a drug developer, I think it's amazing, because we cannot forget about those tumors that still don't have. As I said, breast cancer is great to live in this day and time, because if you are lucky and you get breast cancer, you have options. But if you get pancreatic cancer, if you get sarcoma, you still have very few options. And it's not what we want for our patients. For these patients, sometimes are young, and there's not, you know, there's a lot of work to be done. So I think as a company, I'm very proud of the fact that we really are going after some of the highest unmet needs in nice. Oncology. I'm very happy.
And that's what you want, right? From a talent attraction, getting up in the morning. It's most people who have a scientific or medical background, such as you, Ilaria, they want to know that I'm working on technology which is exciting, which is new, and/or making a big impact into perhaps unmet need, right? And that's not to, put down other area, cardiovascular statins or whatever. It's still important.
Absolutely.
But from a selling point, from standing out the crowd, this is what, really gets people talking, right? It gets people excited. I'm gonna shift the conversation forward, because I know I don't want to be stealing too much of your time, because I can speak to you all day. The other area that excites me and interests me is US versus Europe. Okay. And now, obviously, we have better accents, you and I, than our American colleagues. But outside of that, I wanna know. Here's a question I get a lot from people. Do I need to go to the US to make a big career in the pharma, biotech, drug development world? A lot of people think they need to spend, a number of years in the US to do that. So first question is, why do people think that? And do you agree with that statement? You can be honest. You don't have to say, maybe. Be like, if you actually do think it's a big benefit for people to be in the US for a few years, say it. Okay, so why do people say that, and what's your opinions on it?
Okay. So I think, yes, I think, but it's not just the US. I think having a multinational experience is a tremendous value for somebody that wants to embark in this. If one could even get Asia into the mix, that would be fantastic. Yes. My personal experience is that knowing how clinical development works across an ocean or two is extremely important. In our daily jobs, we, of course, deal with the science, but we also deal with regulations, standards, regulatory environments, standard of care, cultural biases. And having lived or known different sides of this coin is extremely important. For those of us that have been lucky enough, for example, to go through our submissions and approval, I have been, lucky and blessed with that. You really realize that getting a drug approved in the US versus getting a drug approved in Europe is different. let's not talk about Asia, because that's a very different word. And even Asia is not, we say Asia, but boy, Asia is a word, right? Of different places, different cultures, and different things. So knowing, having the experience on both sides, and I wouldn't say you want to go into pharma, immediately move to the US and live there for the rest of your life. Actually, if you are a European and you can start your career in Europe and then experience the US and then decide what you want to do, you can go back to Europe or stay. That is, in my experience, that was my experience, and I really think it helped me a lot, because it's different. It's different words, it's different ways of working. Even, you know, I don't want to get into details, but the healthcare systems are different, you know, public, private, mixed, insurance. These are all things that a drug developer needs to understand, because even if we are involved with the science side of it, you always have to work with the end in mind. So you're the molecule that is just the molecule for you will eventually grow into a drug, and eventually will get to the patient. And how it gets there, do they have to buy it? Do they have to pay for it? Can you provide it free of charge? They may not seem important things to me at the beginning when I start giving the first person the first dose, but they are already important. So knowing how things work, it's crucial. So I would say yes, but not just the US. If somebody can and has the ability to join a company with international capabilities, get yourself to experience more than one. And my advice to the young people, to the junior people that join pharma, from the day one, make sure you make your objective clear. I would like to have an international experience. Whether you start from the US and you want to go to Europe, or Europe, US, or Japan, Australia, it doesn't matter. It's important to really experience different sides of this job. I think the preconceived notion that we have to go to the US is also coming from the fact that a lot of the big pharma companies do clinical development mostly in the US, even if they are European based. But that's because the infrastructure sometimes in the US is a bit easier to navigate. But I would say, don't get, if you can, if people can, personal life, circumstances, preference, of course, they will get to be a part of the decision. But if you can, absolutely get an international experience. Whichever side of the ocean you are, try to get on the other side for a little bit.
Then the final question is going to be, if I was a CEO and I have very early assets, let's say preclinical ADCs or phase one, and I'm thinking about the US, right? It's in the back of my head. I'm thinking to myself, I know at some point I need to have some US footprint in order to get that Series B or IPO, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What should they, let's break that question down even more. What could they be doing now at preparation? Where could they go wrong? What should they know about? I keep throwing lots of multiple big long questions at you, Ilari, which is the biggest error you can do as an interviewer. but yeah, I throw that at you and I'll see how you untangle it.
Well, to be very honest, if you are a European CEO with a great portfolio of preclinical ADCs, you have no choice. You have to develop them globally. Okay. No regulatory agency would really love a package that comes only from one country on one side of the world. I would say Europe is a bit more diverse in that term, so maybe. But to be very honest, trying and think about developing drugs without the support of the US, not as a country, but physical sites and patients and physicians, as I would say, is very narrow-minded. So how do you get to the US?
Thoughts?
There are many options. You can...
Sorry. So I was just going to jump in there on that thought then. So they don't need someone in the US to do that. They could do it through a third party, right? A CRO or whatever. Yet still many decide to hire in the US to achieve what you just said. Why do you think that is?
I think it connects a bit to what we were saying before. Working with you know, clinical sites in a country, working with regulatory authorities in a country, requires understanding the culture and the ways of working of a country. I'm not going into the market piece of this because, of course, if you think about it from a market perspective, the US are probably the more profitable of markets, but that comes later. If you think about how you develop your drug right, you have to have boots on the ground, if you will, in the US, and you have to have people that know how to interact, especially with the FDA, because FDA and EMA are not the same thing. They're similar in many ways. They're very similar in the way they behave, but their rules, regulations, and paths are very different. You have to have people experience, and usually that experience comes from having worked with them and having been in the same country as them. So I think that the companies that do this more successfully are the companies that are at least have minimal, you know, a core group on the two sides of the ocean. Again, going back to my company is an European company. My company is Swiss.
Yeah.
But we have offices in Switzerland, UK, is it you, and US. But the reason why we have it is not trivial, is because we need people in the different areas to provide us with the understanding of the environment, regulatory environment, and clinical environment, academic environments, very different, and connections with, for example, connections with the key leaders, the key experts in fields. They cannot be all in the US, they cannot be all in Europe. They have to be, you know, there has to be a little bit of a mix. Not to mention time zones, because it can become really difficult to work with California and Poland at the same time if you're based in Switzerland, trust me. But that's a practical thing. But from a cultural standpoint, I think having boots on the ground on both sides of the ocean is essential to make sure you are integrated and really understand the system you're playing, in my opinion.
No, we'll leave it there. You last point, you said something that's important to you is making sure you inspire younger generation, also female scientists and doctors to pursue this career. Why did you write that, and what message would you like to give them if they're listening now?
To me, I think one of my biggest passion is mentoring, coaching, and empowering younger people, people that are new to this environment, or even people that are in academia and don't know about this. Because I think women, there are still too few women in science. There are still too few women in the C-suite. And I believe that girls and women have to really sometimes be exposed to what the opportunities are for them. There are a lot of women in medicine. In most countries of the Western world, medicine, med schools are 60% women, 40% men. What happens is that a lot of these women don't end up pursuing careers in research. Pharma is, and research in general, is a great way for women to really show how smart they can be, how innovative they can be, how well they can think. And I really enjoy mentoring women, helping them entering the field, growing in the field, and going up in the scale and in the ladder when they are within pharma. There are still too few women at the helm in pharma companies, not just necessarily CEO, but in the C-suites. And I think there should be more. To quote Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she was asked, how many women should be in the Supreme Court? And she said, I don't know, 12? You know, as many as you can, 9, 10, how many you want? Because, you know, women don't have to be penalized just because they're women, but they need to know, they need to be exposed. And if we women that have, you know, our careers are, you know, gone relatively well, we're happy where we are, we are the ones that need to champion that. Having said that, men too need to be exposed too. Male students need to understand that there are ways that they can really contribute to, you know, to the greater good of the patient, they are not necessarily just oh my God, being a doctor and treating 1 to 100 patients. That could be something bigger, could be something in pharma, could be something in research. So I think that for me, it's important for everyone, but women especially, because there's more need there, to be exposed to the potential. Then they make their own decision. I did. I'm happy I never. So I mentor women within my organization. I mentor women outside my organization. I am in contact with my mentees from my, you know, prior lives. And I think it's a very rewarding. And I really encourage my peers, women and men, to really engage in mentoring and coaching and helping younger people, younger generation of drug developers and scientists to grow and see their potential. Because I think that's the only way to advance medicine and to really get to the point where we can say cancer is no longer a deadly disease for everyone. So I think that's my objective, really.
Okay. Well, Ilaria, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for being part of this.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this show. Now, if you've enjoyed it, then click subscribe, leave a review, or just let me know it's valuable. You know what? We all have doubts from time to time, and receiving these small pieces of encouragement can have a huge impact. And of course, if you are looking for a career change or you want to be connected with fantastic people in our networks, then please contact me directly either on my email, charles@deseradeathsearch.com, or on my LinkedIn. You can also find access to more material, courses, and any other stuff which can help you on your leadership and your career journey. Thanks again for listening, and have a great rest of the day.